another episode of Sacred Cinema here on 2XX 98.3 FM, People Powered Radio. I'm your host, Jimmy Bernasconi, and this week's episode is entitled The Love Horse. The love horse. It's come to pay us a visit. You might be thinking, what on earth are you talking about, Jimmy? There's no such thing as a love horse. Well, this week we're going to be focusing on that old adage, you can't put the cart before the horse, which is kind of like a metaphor for you can't put the ends before the means. You've got to do the work before you get the outcome. And we've talked about ends and means and doing hard work many times on the show. I'm talking more, we're going to apply that adage to the realm of love and romantic relationships this week. I guess just relationships in general, but all these films are kind of romantic films. And there's actually quite a lot I want to talk about on this topic, so let's get stuck into it kind of straight away. The films we're going to be talking about this week are American Pie from 1999, directed by Paul and Chris Weitz. We're then going to move on to a new film that came out recently, No Hard Feelings, the one starring Jennifer Lawrence, directed by Gene Stupnitsky. And then we're going to finish off with Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind by Michel Gondry from 2004. But let's kick things off now with American Pie. So I think everyone in the world has probably seen this movie or knows about it. But basically, I want to talk about how, the basic plot, if you haven't seen the film, I guess, is you've got four guys who they've got their big prom coming up, and they all want to lose their virginity before the end of their school year. And it's important that it's four guys, and I think they all kind of represent different iterations of like the modern Western teen, like all kind of like four key archetypes that sort of orbit the core American teen. You've got, you know, Jim is kind of like the dork. You've got Oz, who's clearly the jock. You've got Finch, who's like the intelligent, cultured guy. And then Kevin, I guess you'd say, is like, I guess like the cool guy of the group, or like he's the one that's got the girlfriend. He's got the older brother, Casey Affleck. So I'm gonna call him kind of like the smooth cool guy in that kind of like mainstream cool kind of way. Finch is kind of like the real cool, like Miles Davis cool. But anyway, I want to talk about if we're talking about, you know, the ends justifying the means and putting the cart before the horse kind of thing. You know, in wanting to lose their virginity, design these very rational, strategic, well thought out, systematic plans on how to get laid. But this is probably the best one for why, this is of the films we're talking about, this is probably the best one for why you shouldn't put the cart before the horse. You can't just fake love in order to get sex. You can't fake a true romantic feeling and trick people into doing that. It kind of reminds me a lot, watching it now, because I've seen it plenty of times, but watching it now as I've gotten older, it reminds me a lot of this kind of internet dating pickup culture. You know, if you go on like YouTube and you can look up like top five dating tips for women, or top five signs he likes, or five things that every guy should do to make every girl like them, and that kind of like pickup culture, there's a rule book, and if you follow it, it's kind of like got an incel vibe to it. Like there's a systematic, you know, tick all the boxes and you'll therefore be attractive kind of thing. It does have that kind of quality to it, where strategies and tactics to get a boyfriend or a girlfriend people seem to think that they'll work rather than having a genuine connection with the person. You know, obviously weird examples like, you know, nod your head when someone's talking to make it look like you're interested. But the film, the basic moral of the film is that, you know, In order to actually become attractive, to become a mature player on the romantic stage, you have to genuinely embrace these things. You can't just, you know, learn all the tricks of the trade and manufacture through like an artificial process becoming a suave and interesting person. You genuinely have to embrace these things. And I want to take it a step further and say, I think what the film does well in terms of them all being kind of this archetypal qualities is that you have to genuinely embrace the deficits that you have, that you have to accept in yourself, that are kind of in direct conflict or diametrically opposed to your current status quo, being that status quo that you might have in the sense that if you're someone that can't get with someone, that you've got to look at what are those things that are diametrically opposed from what you're currently doing that mean that you are, you know, a virgin in this case. And you see that moral kind of in every single high school film of that era, where the jock dates the nerd girl. Like High School Musical, you get that. Or Grease, you get something like that. I mean, that's not even of this era. It's even She's All That, all those sorts of those films. It's got a very animus quality to it, which we've talked about before, which is a Jungian term, which is like the female projection of the self or the male projection of the self. We're seeing kind of like the perfect opposite of us, and in order to better individuate ourselves, we need to learn to genuinely embrace the opposite of who we are. I think we best see that depicted in the character of Oz. He's the one, we see at the start, he's the jock, and he's the one that at the start of the film, he's on this date with a college girl, and he thinks he can just sort of memorize some smooth lines, and that's sort of what gets her into bed, and calls himself Casanova and that sort of thing. But what he has to do is actually join the choir, and he has to actually enjoy it, to the point that, and I think this is where the film is actually quite clever, to the point that sex no longer matters to him, and ironically, that is how he actually gets sex. Or does he? Because part of there's ambiguity in that in the film. Like, they ask him about it after the fact, and obviously we don't actually see what actually happens. We know that they're sort of lying down on that lake house thing at Stifler's party, but we don't ever actually genuinely see what really happens. But the best part of the movie is that ambiguity, where as audience members, we too stop actually caring about whether he actually did or didn't actually have sex by the end. And that kind of is that's the kind of I think the moral of the story very well depicted in that scene and that moment where we no longer actually care whether he did or didn't, because he doesn't care and he realizes that sex is not actually the end goal in the end. There's plenty of other examples of that as well. I like how Finch as well, who's kind of hated by Stifler throughout the film, has sex with Stifler's mum. So he sort of learns to amalgamate with a Stifler, with the female Stifler, his own personal anima in a way. So he learns to literally embrace a Stifler, which is his opposite throughout the film. But what if putting the cart before the horse is kind of absolutely necessary, right? Let's say where love is something that has great utility, because I mean it does, kind of in every part of the world, and it opens up all kinds of doors for us if we do, let's say, weaponize it. Or should we just sort of, live in a world where those who aren't in love, the world isn't for people who aren't in love? How can people exist in a world where love is a currency, where they don't have any of it in their bank balance, let's say? Before we do move into our next film, just to remind you, I listen to 2XX 98.3 FM, People Powered Radio. I'm your host, Jimmy Burns, going for the remainder of this half-hour slot. And make sure to keep listening to 2XX for more quality radio programming. And also consider jumping onto our website to consider subscribing to the show or sponsoring the show. That would all be very much appreciated. And I would love you very much for that, whether you're a horse or otherwise. We're going to move on now to this film, No Hard Feelings, directed by Gene Stupnitsky. And the plot centers on Jennifer Lawrence's character, who's this kind of surfy girl who lives in Montauk, which is going to be a very important location for us this week. And basically, she finds out on Craigslist that she can have sex with this young, shy 19-year-old boy in order to get a car, and that's important to her because she's an Uber driver. And again, we have this anima animus dynamic where she's, this surfy, attractive, tanned woman in her 30s, and this young, shy 19-year-old boy is this kind of nerdy, shy guy. And it sounds a bit silly, but I actually think the film is kind of clever in how it's this modern tale that very kind of perfectly mirrors a lot of old stories about the commercial and economic aspect of love. And that's what I was trying to say before. It's like, how are you meant to navigate a world that's obsessed with love if you don't have any love in your bank balance, let's say, or capacity to love, or you don't love anyone at the time? And I think it's very sort of akin to those 19th century novels. It reminded me of that scene in Little Women where Florence Pugh gets angry and she's like, don't tell me that marriage isn't an economic decision, because of course marriage is always going to be an economic decision, or any kind of relationship is. So you could give this film, and I suppose many others like it, the subtitle of like Love in the Time of Capitalism. Because we have this same basic premise again of American Pie, where, you can't put the horse before the cart. She can't just force this guy to go out with or to have sex with her so she can get this car. We learn that there's more to it than that, and we're going to explain that in a second. But this film has a little bit of an extra dimension to it than American Pie, right? Which in American Pie, you know, the moral is, you know, you actually have to fall in love with someone in order for them to want to sleep with you. She can't really fall in love with this guy because she's older and it's a bit weird. And just when we watch it, it's kind of, we kind of get like a yucky feeling if we contemplate the idea of them actually getting together in the end. And I don't mean to give much away. If you're planning on seeing the film, you don't want any spoilers. Maybe change over now. But what I would say is that, and we'll talk about this a little bit more in a second, but they don't end up together in the end. And I think that's important. And, you know, we could say, you know, Finch and Stifler's mum, it works out for them, but they're not the protagonists in that film. He's but an iteration that sort of stems off the main core character. But in this film, Jennifer Lawrence and the young kid are sort of the protagonists. And as I sort of hinted at a second ago, of course, Jennifer Lawrence's problems aren't simply solved, though. Even though she, you know, needs a car for her own commercial, you know, for her own subsistence, for her own survival, and we kind of understand why she's doing this, and it works as a really interesting analogy for sex work as well, and that's pretty on the nose in the film. Even though she has to go through this in order to subsist, her problems aren't solved when she tricks him into falling in love with her, the young boy, and so. I guess what we'd say is that there's always an element of humanity that is prioritized in any kind of human relationship, no matter what socioeconomic backgrounds or what have you are present at the time. It's almost like no matter what, you know, even if the victim is the most archetypally privileged person that we can imagine, we still want to make sure that humanity is prioritized at the end of the day, compassion, empathy, that sort of thing. And so, well, as I mentioned Montauk before, if you're not from there, and I'm not from New York or Long Island or that whole area, but Montauk, and it's very well explained in the film, is like the place that rich New Yorkers go for their summer vacation, and they kind of go in and out. And Jennifer Lawrence, she lives there full time. She's like a surfer girl, and she kind of resents all the rich people that come in. And the whole reason why she needs to work for Uber is so she can pay off the property taxes for this beautiful house that she inherited from her mother that all the rich people want to swoop up and buy cheap and then sell high. So there's you can make a very, very interesting Marxist critique of this film about how in a capitalist system, love too becomes a commodity as a means for the bourgeois to exploit the proletariat or something like that. But I wanted to focus specifically in making this point about the element of humanity being a priority here. I want to talk about the idea how the intensity of a problem, or talk about the sort of the literary technique of how the intensity of a problem can be maximally depicted when it's shown to affect the most powerful kinds of people it could affect. And despite their power, despite their privilege, the audience still feels sorry for them. So, pardon me. In the film, this boy is a rich kid. So you might want to scoff at him at the start of the film, but because of what's going on in his life and what she's doing to him, despite the fact that he has so much more economic privilege than her, despite that, we still feel sorry for him. And this reminded me a lot of, we talked about one of the earliest episodes we did the film If, the Lindsay Anderson film If, which is set at a private English boys' school, and we talk about the fact that even these people can be exploited by the systems of oppression in that film, that goes to show just how palpable they are. And there's a similar dynamic in this film that despite the fact that this guy is so rich and privileged, that even he can be exploited by this concept of being betrayed in the realm of love and romance, it must be a very palpable force. And I have to say, just on a very personal level, I saw this film at a cinema in an area where people probably would generally have the view that, like, rich white collar boys don't really deserve our sympathy. A real kind of inner city vibe place. If you live in Sydney, you can probably figure out where I might be referring to. And they were very audibly sympathetic towards that character. And just on a sort of a socio-cultural level, I thought that was really interesting how the film was powerful enough to sort of get that from those audience. I'm not to paint everybody who goes to this cinema with a broad brush. But I just have to be honest with you that it did occur to me at the time. I thought, well, that's quite powerful that this was saying that this character, and it's a very good performance too. I got to say, he's quite a funny guy, and you know, it does make sense. And obviously, people aren't just so prejudiced to think, oh, just because the guy's a, you know, a rich little kid, he's necessarily a bad guy, and we can't like him. But we certainly see in this film that faking love is such a no-no that we even hate it when it hurts the most privileged in society. But we've got to talk a little bit about how it differs to American Pie, because at this point we're kind of just saying the same thing in a way. Well, there's this commercial aspect happening here. And as I mentioned, as I hinted at before, the two main characters in the film, they don't actually end up together. Love is not for them. I mean, they're at different stages of life. There's a huge age gap. They're two very different people. And it wouldn't make sense that, you know, I think that the point of the film is really about freedom for the individual and making sure that she has sort of economic stability. That's kind of what Jennifer Lawrence's character is trying to get. She's got to get past herself in order to clean up her life and make something of herself. And for the little boy, for the younger guy, he has to sort of learn to be a grown-up. That doesn't necessarily mean relying on each other as such. And we kind of learn that, it's a shame when love has to be weaponized, and we shouldn't force it as much. In the same way that we shouldn't force sex, we shouldn't force love. So to put that in terms that relate to the films, when we're talking about American Pie, we talk about, you know, on one hand, we shouldn't be weaponizing love as a means to get sex. We should embrace love, but you know, love isn't for everyone at all times and for all people of all times. And in the same way that we shouldn't be forcing sex as a means of reaching love, we shouldn't be forcing love for all of its goodness. We shouldn't be forcing love as a means to forward ourselves economically or otherwise, and whether that should be something that we do through our own kind of individuation by facing ourselves and not relying on other people, let's say. So it does sort of seem like this love business causes some real issues. And, you know, maybe we should just let this love horse bolt, you know, maybe it'll just sort of let it free. You know, off you go, boy. Go destroy all the topsoil in Kosciuszko National Park, let's say. But personally, I wanted to see a kiss at the end of this film. Maybe not Jennifer Lawrence and that guy, but I felt as an audience member we needed to see a Hollywood kiss at the end of that film for some reason or other. And maybe that's because love has this sort of inevitable quality. It's everywhere for a reason in human society. So let's kind of bring everything together now with the third and final film for today. And this is Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind from 2004, directed by Michel Gondry. And if you haven't seen this one, in short, it's, you know, just Jim Carrey and Kate Winslet are the two main characters. And it's kind of about how a couple decide to erase each other from their memory. I mean, Jim Carrey is the main protagonist, but Kate Winslet's character does it too. Her name's Clementine and his name's Joel. And if the other films are about putting the cart before the horse and how that can be dangerous, this is a film, I guess, where the characters have put the horse before the cart, and they rode to town, but then they really didn't like the journey, and they said, well, we don't want horses, we don't want carts, we don't want anything. But as the film progresses, you kind of do have to want, you know, you got to get to town somehow. But that's enough of the metaphor. Let's actually talk about the films themselves. The first point I want to make about this film is the inevitability of love. So even when these characters erase each other from each other's memories, they still find each other again in the real world. And that's not just that doesn't just go for Joel and Clementine, Jim Carrey and Kate Winslet's characters, but also for Kirsten Dunst and Tom Wilkinson's characters, who are the people that she's the secretary and he's the main scientist that runs this business that allows people to eradicate people from their memories. And their relationship is really important to the film, the Kirsten Dunst and Tom Wilkinson relationship, because in one way the film could very easily go down this slippery slope of being like, well, love's inevitable, get on with it, stop complaining. What it's saying is, with their relationship, is you shouldn't necessarily stay with someone just because love is enduring. Like, yes, it is the case that, you know, those memories are enduring and you'll go through the rest of your life and still have some, you know, some element of feeling or emotion towards that person that you once loved. And we can all relate to that. Everybody knows that. I don't care how happy your marriage is. I'm sure you can think of someone in your past that has a special place in your heart. Maybe it was just you know, a boy you kissed when you were 12 years old at the blue light disco or something. But everybody sort of has that kind of feeling. I think with their relationship, it's kind of saying that their arc is sort of saying that we can move on to other partners, i.e. Mark Ruffalo, if they are willing to accept our past and be up for the challenge, and then we're willing to look forward as well. But to shift to the other side of the spectrum, the other side of the coin, what about Joel and Clementine? Why are they different to, say, Kirsten Dunst and Tom Wilkinson's relationship? Well, this brings me to my second point I want to make about this film, which is that, and in making this in this point, we do have to sort of unpack the elephant in the room when we talk about this film. So I'm sure a couple of dear listeners have already picked up on this, which is, you know, talking about Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, Jimmy, you know, this film has kind of been cancelled a little bit because it's kind of one of the classic depictions of the manic pixie dream girl. And if you're not familiar with that term, I'm sure you are because it's sort of thrown around a lot these days. It's basically this infuriating, unrealistic trope in indie comedies throughout the 2000s that played into a kind of male gaze. So people didn't like, or women particularly didn't like it because we have these female characters who are kind of like a nerdy, kind of quirky guy imagined up the perfect woman. She'd be sort of all over the place and jumpy and she sort of wears funny clothes and often has coloured hair, and she doesn't act like a normal woman who kind of has their own agency and their own friends and isn't this kind of imagined version of a fully entertaining woman. That, and I think one of the key elements is that she only exists in the eye of the protagonist. She only exists subject to the male protagonist. She doesn't have her own life. She's sort of this clapping monkey that entertains him and keeps him stimulated in a constant sort of almost like a pornographic sense. Like she only exists in reference to him. Like she's constantly tethered to him. And while she bounces around a lot, she always comes back and forth and that sort of thing. And there's plenty of other examples throughout the films. And I really do want to do a week when we actually just talk about it on its own. But there's two things I want to say about the manic pixie dream girl. First of all, is that it is unrealistic. I'm not saying it's not, but there are manic women. I mean, there are manic people. And there are people that sort of attach themselves to people and love hard and hate hard and change the color of their hair depending on how they're feeling that day. We shouldn't just say that because it's something that we don't want to be or we don't want to be for men, that it's something that doesn't exist. I think it does exist to some degree. But more importantly, this is a film, right? So we don't have to think of her as a real person. We talk about this a lot on the show. When you watch a film, you don't have to see it necessarily as a depiction of reality. I mean, it's a very surreal film anyway. I think a more mature way of thinking about it is that she is the manic pixie dream girl, right? Like, she's Joel's perfect opposite. She's his dream girl in a way. And sort of the film kind of asks this question, right? Like, she, like in the dream girl in the sense that she makes up for all of his deficits. She's everything he's not. Again, akin to this idea about the anima and the anima. So what you could say that is that the film is really about how we are inevitably haunted by the idea of, by a diametric opposite. Right, even though it is imaginary, right, it actually needs to be imaginary. It needs to have this maximal archetypal quality to it, a exhausted in pure form kind of way. The film is really about the extent to which we need to let go or embrace them. And of course, it's somewhere in the middle because we don't want to become that person. But at the same time, because they're making up for our deficits, there's something to learn from them. And I think you could actually say this film is very akin to the Ingmar Bergman film Persona, where we have the two opposites that in seeing their mirror image in the other, or the perfect opposite in the other, they sort of lament what they could have been, or the person he could have been, you know, a feminine person who is outgoing, who is a bit more manic. He's very shy and cold and reserved, right? But more broadly, particularly, or not, maybe not more broadly, but less broadly, but particularly in the realm of love and relationships, right? Let's bring things back here. We could say that the film is kind of about whether we can reconcile opposing forces in the romantic realm, right? And this is an idea that we're all very familiar with. Can we reconcile the fact that we're pinned with or tied with someone that is so different to us? That, you know, if you're a woman, you might be with a man. And if you're short, he might be tall. You might be very clean and tidy. He might be real dirty and sloppy. He might be loud. You might be quiet, and et cetera, et cetera. We often find ourselves, you know, opposites attract. But how can we reconcile that when opposites and obviously necessarily clash? And so, and this idea of reconciling opposites is a very clear motif in the film. I mean, I've mentioned before, sort of Clementine is loud and outgoing while Joel is shy and depressive. Obviously, Clementine's changing hair is very much a metaphor in the film. You know, it goes from blue to orange, which is two direct opposites, you know, one symbolic of the cold and one symbolic of the warm. And then, and paralleling that is we have this motif of the sun and the snow. And interestingly, you know, this film is also set in Montauk, just like in No Hard Feelings, which is kind of perfect considering that No Hard Feelings is a film about forcing the emergence of love, and it's set in Montauk in the summer, whereas Eternal Sunshine is a film about forcing love apart, and it's set in Montauk in the winter. So it's kind of like this perfect opposites, contrary motion thing. And clearly it's a proper roller coaster ride for these two, which is why it's kind of perfect that Clementine is a bit manic. It sort of means that the most, you know, it means that we're in the realm of the most extreme relationship. You know, this is the most extreme relationship one can imagine. Again, we're in the land of extremes, like we were with No Hard Feelings when talking about the idea of, you know, if it can happen to him, it can happen to anyone. You know, and if it can work for these two, it can work for anyone. But what's the main takeaway here? Well, I think we should go back through everything and then come back to what Eternal Sunshine kind of ultimately says. Well, when we talked about American Pie, we talked about how love can't just be a tool. It can't just be a key to the realm of sex and intimacy. You know, if we want those things, we need to actually learn to love. We need to embrace love. And you know, ironically, those things like sex and intimacy and things like that, they become redundant because we realize how much more important and how much better love is than those things. But then what about people who aren't in love or where love is, you know, actually needs to be seen as a bit of a commodity or a bit of a weapon? You know, in a world where love is this highly valuable currency, how are we supposed to get around without it? You know, if there is a need to force love, well, this is going to lead to broken hearts, right? And you know, forcing love is, you know, just as bad as forcing sex or intimacy. You know, love is a great thing, but if you force everyone to have it, you're going to lead to some broken hearts. You're going to have to, there's going to be some deceit along the way. So I guess what we could say is that love has this kind of, I don't want to say just an inevitable quality, but it kind of shows up everywhere. It kind of spreads like a gas, you know. It can be spread thin, but you kind of find it everywhere in the world. I mean, it crops up for better or for worse. A bit like in that song. If you ever heard that song, "But Beautiful," you know, love is funny or it's sad, it's quiet or it's mad, it's a good thing or it's bad. It sort of creeps up everywhere, whether it's invited or whether it isn't. And I think the best way to sort of think about how we should deal with it, particularly in a relationship, is best depicted in the final scene of Eternal Sunshine, which I think sort of perfectly depicts the reality of an authentic loving relationship in a way that only a film can. So having ridden through all the highs and lows of love, Joel and Clementine, they find this moment of beauty at the very end of this film playing on a beach. And while that sounds very sort of traditional, archetypal, you know, playing on a beach, very sunny, very beautiful, the beach is up in Montauk during the winter. It's covered in snow. They're playing on a beach that's covered in snow. So as to say that we should enjoy our romantic relationships. Like, we should enjoy, you know, we should play on the beach. We should enjoy the sun and the surf and everything like that. But we also need to equally learn how to do so, not just in the sun and the sand, but in the snow when we're uncomfortable, battling the wild, freezing winds of a storm. Because I think that's probably the only way that we'll ever learn to fully tame or break in love.
Well, that's all we've got time for this week, unfortunately, on Sacred Cinema here on 2XX 98.3 FM, People Powered Radio. Thanks so much for tuning in, and stay tuned for more quality radio programming here on 2XX, or jump onto our website to consider subscribing to the station or sponsoring the show or listening online. And you can do all of that on our website. But thanks so much for tuning in again. We'll see you next week, and have a great week, I suppose. Cheers.